Welcome back to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry. Here's your host, Brother Robert Johnson.
All right, thanks for coming back. This is episode 269. This episode of Whence Came You is brought to you by MasonicRevival.com. That's a Masonic design group bringing you the latest fashion trends in Masonic accessories and regalia. You can check out their newest neckties, aprons, and accessories at MasonicRevival.com. All right, so in the news this week, I should mention that, of course, there was no Masonic Roundtable episode last week. We were all under the weather. As I'm sure you could hear in the last episode, I sounded pretty congested. It only got worse from there. I ended up with a middle ear infection. My son got pneumonia. Brother Nick Johnson had pneumonia. The other fellows were sick, too. It was just a nightmare. So our thanks to everybody who understood, but we're going to be on this week. We just postponed that episode, so we'll be having a good show here coming up Tuesday at 10, 9 Central that you can check us out on Google Hangouts and in perpetuity there on YouTube. And of course, we'll have the audio podcast as well a couple hours after the broadcast has ended. Just recently, I thought I would mention the crazy conversation that we actually had just on Facebook the other day and just on my own personal page, but a lot of fellas who follow the public posts felt they wanted to comment, and we had a good discussion. I had posted a meme image of a mountain with a flag on the top, and it said my favorite quote of the day, and it was by Worshipful Brother Scott Duball, who's a dear friend and brother, who said regarding petitioning a Masonic lodge, quote, "If you don't want to become the Worshipful Master, don't bother." As in, don't bother petitioning if you don't want to lead the lodge. The reason I posted the meme, I made it and I posted it to push discussion, and it did exactly what I thought it would do and was exactly what I wanted, which was kind of a shock value. Let's talk about that and just push really hard and see what people thought, because we're always talking about membership numbers, active numbers, right? So we always have this 10%. We have these 90% of our members who just go out there and they pay the dues. They never come in. And they're not contributing anything other than paying their dues. Yeah, they might say they're a Mason or whatever, and they'll gather a little bit of excitement one day when somebody asks them about the Masonic ring that they wear, yet they've not come back to lodge in 20 years for whatever reason. And that very well may be because they don't like the lodge or the dynamic there, they hate it, or for whatever reason. But the point being, it's not so much that we were saying and meant it. We wanted to start the conversation, and see what people had to say. And initially, people were like, really? You can't be serious. That's ridiculous. Your goal shouldn't be to lead the lodge. It should be to do these other things. And we totally agree. Nothing that was said in the thread of emails was things we did not agree with or that I didn't agree with. Brother Scott Duball kept close eye on the thread as well. What we wanted to push was this notion that if you have an urge or a need or a deep-seated feeling to join the Masonic Lodge, you should also be active. You should be at the events. You should be planning events. You should be offering to do something for the lodge in terms of activity, spreading the word, be known, travel to different lodges. We don't have room in this organization for mediocrity, ever. As much as we have our Grand Lodges telling us that our numbers are suffering, and you all know my stance on that, I don't think we're suffering in numbers. I think we're refining our numbers, and we're refining our process, and what we're going to end up with is real Freemasonry, and I'm excited about that. But the sad part is, of course, our numbers are going to continue to dwindle because we now see what we need in this organization, which is active members. And with an organization of 6 million worldwide, those numbers are a few years old. I would venture to say that there's probably just that same 10%. And if you take that 10% and you look at the active membership, do we really need these big lodges? Probably not. Do we need as many lodges as we have? Definitely not. I mean, Illinois alone has 468. The point of this post was to push the idea and to get people to acknowledge that we need active membership, and that's probably something that we should broach when talking to a prospective member. If you're a prospective member out there and you want to come into this fraternity and you want nothing more than to join the fraternity and you're satisfying a curiosity that you're never going to come back, read a book and stay out. I just don't think there's a need or a place for that kind of a person in this fraternity. I feel like we really need active members. A good friend and brother, fellow Midnight Freemason contributor, Brother Dan Gentry, Doc said, well, define active. I can't really define active, and I guess that's my fault. Whatever it is, go to Lodge. Eric Diamond said it, you know, a year ago. Go to Lodge. And I laughed. I wanted to turn it into a hashtag campaign, hashtag go to Lodge. So it's just important to think about that. And I really didn't want to ruffle any feathers when I posted that. I wanted us to understand what we need in this fraternity. And what we need is not mediocrity. We need excellence. We don't have time to invest in somebody who's not going to invest time in us. I hope that makes sense. The next thing I was going to mention is that it was kind of fun. I was actually on another podcast just recently. I did an interview with the Project Bring Me to Life podcast. They are a really interesting podcast in that their tagline is Awakening Humanity to Spirituality in Higher Consciousness. So they've got some really great interviews and things on their website. They're hosted by a gentleman named CeeLo, and sometimes he is joined by his counterpart, and they do a great show. They interviewed me about a topic called the Temple of Man, and I think I dove a little bit into Freemasonry, and I gave a brief synopsis on the Temple of Man, and we talked a little bit about that, which was the main topic, not so much Freemasonry. So when that comes out, we'll be sharing links. Keep an eye out. I just got the flyer for this new event that I'll be participating in. So Thursday, January 26th, 2017, I will be presenting for University Masonic Lodge number 1190 AF and AM out of Austin, Texas. I'm going to be speaking on the Word, Myth, Legend, and Science at the 8th Annual Festive Board. There will be a social hour and a silent auction at 6 p.m. Dinner will be served at 7 p.m. and it'll be at the Austin Club at 110 East 9th Street. All the proceeds will benefit Austin's Children's Shelter, UT Elementary School, Anthropos Arts, and other local children's charities through the University Masonic Charitable Foundation. For more information or for tickets, you need to email foundation@uml1190.org. Contributions to the UMCF and silent auction purchases are tax deductible to the maximum extent allowed by law. So we're going to have a great presentation. I'll be talking about the Word. It'll be an expanded presentation from what you may have seen me do in the past. We're going to have a good time, and I'm really excited about it. And it all goes to a great cause. So if you are so inclined and you are in Austin Thursday, January 26th, please consider picking up a ticket and listening to some quote-unquote light Masonic education. I will also be at MasonicCon 2017. So MasonicCon is really cool, pretty much one of the biggest Masonic conventions in the United States. I've heard that it's far better than Masonic Week, mostly because you can go to everything. Who's coming to Masonic Week? Of course, I'll be there. They're going to have Richard Casero, Ryan Flynn, Masonic artist, Angel Miller. There's going to be the Setting Mall Study Circle. Greg Kaminsky and the Occult of Personality podcast is going to be there. That's worth it alone. Brothers Blend Coffee will be there. The Grip and Word Handmade Haberdashery will be there. Nava and the Muslim Grottos will be there. Masoit Forest 91 Tall Cedars of Lebanon will be there. The New England Grotto Association. MasonicScarves.com will be there. Oscar Aline will be there. The Masonic Light podcast will be there. Aleppo Shriners, David Brody, the Massachusetts Lodge of Research, and so much more. There's even going to be a Master Mason-only panel discussion on esoteric symbolism with panelists, including one of my favorites, Brother Greg Kaminsky from St. John's Lodge in Boston, Right Worshipful Brother Roger Williams, Lodge number 32 in East Providence, Worshipful Brother Oscar Aline from Wallkill, Lodge 672 in Walden, New York. I believe I will be on the panel as well. So it's going to be really cool. If you want to become a Tall Cedar, you can bring $25. They're going to be doing that there as well as for the grotto. They've got a ton of parking, it looks like. So if you go over to EB, that's Echo Bravo, 1870.org, EB1870, you can click on MasonicCon 2017 and see all those awesome details I just ran through. So with all that amazing stuff, let's get into this week's paper, The Ancient Mysteries of Egypt and Greece, Part 1, by Worshipful Brother D. McLaren, PBGD, and we will read part two next week or the week after. And this is from the Transactions of the Manchester Association for Masonic Research, published in 1929. In the explanation of the first trestle board, it is stated that the usages and customs of Freemasonry correspond in a great degree with the mysteries of ancient Egypt, and there are some brethren who, in their belief in the antiquity of our order, would derive its origin from these mysteries. It is generally believed that Egypt was the home of the mysteries, and I desire, as far as time will permit, to trace shortly how these Egyptian mysteries gradually found their way into and influenced the native religions of the nations with which Egypt came in contact. Probably no other nation of that time was better fitted by its mental structure, as revealed by what little we know of its literature and the comparatively advanced state of its knowledge, to become the home of mysteries. The amount of knowledge acquired by the priestly caste and revealed only to those chosen by them to share it in that knowledge was very extensive, and for these times very accurate. Living in a country where a yearly division of land was necessary owing to the varying amounts of the Nile floods, a knowledge of geometry was gradually attained, which included not only the geometry of areas but also of solids and conic sections. Dr. Gao says in a reference on the subject, quote, "Beyond question, Egyptian geometry, such as it was the germ from which grew that magnificent science to which every Englishman is indebted for the first lessons in right seeing and thinking." End quote. The scholars of the Nile Valley also possessed knowledge of the rudiments of trigonometry, and their approximation to the value of pi was not improved for many centuries. Ames, a scribe of the Hyksos dynasty, 1900 BC, gave the value of pi as equaling 16/9 to the second power, or equal to 3.1605, a remarkably good approximation for the period when geometry was little more than mensuration. Quote, "In matters arithmetical, they possessed a knowledge of the three progressions, arithmetical, geometrical, and harmonic. In astronomy, without the help of accurate instruments of observation at the disposal of modern observers of the heavens, they had measured the obliquity of the ecliptic, had explained the solar and lunar eclipses, and at a very early date were in possession of a knowledge of the precession of the equinoxes. In arts and manufactures, they attained to a very high standard of excellence. As potters, they had few rivals, and they knew how to blow glass. They used saws, levers, and balances, and were skillful builders of ships. The gigantic and wonderful hall of Karnak and the pillars of Luxor, not to mention the pyramids, testify that, as masons, they accomplished feats which could hardly be achieved in our mechanical and scientific age. And it is not too much to assert that the measurements that Greece handed on to Rome and Europe in the Middle Ages were derived from Egypt." End quote. After the interesting paper read before the association last year in, quote-unquote, "The Life of Sethos" by worshipful brother R. E. Wallace James, I do not consider it necessary to deal with any of the Egyptian mysteries in particular. In general, candidates for these mysteries, and after purification, by washing and time spent in darkness, had to give his assent to the rules of the society, and an oath of fidelity was required of him, after which he was restored to light. A password was given to him, and signs of recognition, and he was instructed in the names and attributes of the gods, and received instruction in the then known sciences. In some cases, the highest honor granted was participation in the election of a king. A belief in the immortality of the soul was, no doubt, communicated to those admitted to their mysteries. On the walls of the temple of Philae were recorded the death, resurrection, and ascension, and deification of the god to whom it was sacred. Not much is known of these mysteries, and what we do know of them is derived from the writings of the Greeks, and chiefly those of Iamblichus. But it may be safely said that they never, in Egypt, developed into conscious centers of orgiastic license, such as made a byword of the Bacchanalia at Rome and the Dionysiac ceremonies in Thrace. All this knowledge was the possession of the priest astronomers, who selfishly acquired a predominant power by policy of silence outside their order, even on these purely scientific matters. As regards their religion, Egypt suffered from a superfluity of gods and goddesses. It has been said that an enumeration of them would result in, quote, compilations resembling census returns. Herodotus tells us how a pharaoh of the 12th dynasty undertook to build the labyrinth as a temple to accommodate all the gods and found it necessary to construct no fewer than 3,000 apartments. Here, as in the other great religions of the world, is found a trinity, in this case consisting of Osiris, Isis, and Horus. Osiris, variously styled the manifester of good, lord of the lords, king of the gods, was the chief of the gods worshipped by the Egyptians, and represented the Nile and the sun, of which the life of Egypt entirely depended. After having conquered all Egypt and given it excellent laws, he was overcome by his evil brother Set, who, by a stratagem, enclosed him in a chest and threw him into the sea. His wife Isis, having heard of this, set out in sorrow in search of the chest, which was driven ashore at Byblos. And enclosed in a tree which had suddenly sprung up, Isis eventually obtained the chest and the body of Osiris, which his brother had divided into 14 pieces. This was restored to life, and he afterwards became a judge of the dead. Isis was the chief goddess of the Egyptian mythology and, as I have just said, was the wife and sister of Osiris. Her worship was more particularly associated with Memphis, but at a later date, it spread all over Egypt. The mysteries in connection with the celebration lasted for 8 days and consisted of a general purification by washing. Her priests were required to lead chaste lives and accept celibacy. The worship of the third member of this trinity, Horus, the son of Osiris and Isis, was also general throughout Egypt. His eyes were represented by the sun and moon. The festival took place on the 30th Epiphany. The images of Isis and Horus became, in early Christian days, those of the Virgin and the Child, and while one would not identify this trinity of deities with the Christian trinity, the underlying conception of divine Father, Mother, and Son is perhaps akin to it. Among the Egyptians was developed a fairly clear idea of life after death, of punishment and reward, dependent on the life led previous to death. Pythagoras, 569 to 470 BC, a former pupil of the Egyptian priests, taught the immortality of the soul. According to Plutarch, the death of Osiris was celebrated annually throughout Egypt toward the end of November, when the Nile flood was subsiding. According to Herodotus, the grave of Osiris was at Sais in Lower Egypt, where there was a lake on which the sufferings of Osiris were displayed as a mystery by night. While the people mourned and beat their breasts to show their sorrow for the sufferings of the god, an image of a cow made of gilt wood with golden sun between its horns was carried out of the temple where it had been placed at the termination of the previous year's commemoration. This probably represented Isis herself and her search for the dead body of Osiris. In the last day of the ceremonies, the priests, followed by the people, went down to the sea, the priests carrying a shrine containing a golden casket in which water was poured, accompanied with the shout that Osiris was found. A small moon-shaped image was then formed and robed and ornamented, signifying the resurrection of the god. To show their joy, rows of oil lamps were fastened to the outside of the houses, and these burned throughout the night. The origin of Egyptian history is lost in the mists of antiquity. To fix its chronology is not easy. Sometime about the 3rd century before Christ, an Egyptian priest, Manetho, wrote a history of his native country and divided the rulers of Egypt into 31 groups or dynasties. Historians generally have accepted this division, although there is not yet agreement on the chronology. The two leading schools of authorities in this connection, the American and the Berlin, differ widely in dates prior to 1000 BC. Mr. Davidson, who recently published an exhaustive research volume on the Great Pyramids and Egyptian chronology, appears to refute both scholars. A complete synchronism of ancient writers in accord with Archbishop Usher's Bible dates. For my present purpose, namely of tracing the historical points of contact where the influence of Egyptian knowledge and beliefs on the surrounding peoples, and more especially on the Jewish and the Greek nations, occurred, I shall adopt that of Mr. Davidson. It is generally agreed that Lower and Upper Egypt became united into one kingdom under a powerful and warlike chief who became the first pharaoh and whose name was Menes, about 3500 BCE. His capital was situated at Memphis. It is also known that during the 12th dynasty, Egypt, which had formerly been entirely agricultural, now became famous in commerce and came into touch with Europe, as a considerable amount of their trade was carried out with the island of Crete. Since 1894, archaeologists have been carrying on excavations in that island, and their discoveries have upset the previous knowledge of historians, for they find that at the time of their trading with the Egyptians, the inhabitants of the island were more advanced in their arts and sciences than were the Babylonians and the Egyptians. Here, however, is the first point of historical contact between Egypt and Europe, probably 2000 BCE, but of more interest to us as Masons is the intercourse of Egyptians and the Jews. In the Bible, 200 references are made to Egypt and 10 pharaohs are mentioned, although unfortunately their names are not mentioned. The first mention of a pharaoh is found in Genesis 12:10. Where Abraham, the founder of the Hebrew nation, had migrated from Babylonia into the land of Canaan, from which famine forced him to visit the fertile land of Egypt. This took place when Egypt was ruled over by the Hyksos, or the Shepherd King, in the reign of the 17th dynasty. A little more than 200 years after, during the 18th dynasty, that is 100 years before the reign of Tutankhamun, Jacob and his sons were driven by famine to Egypt to join Joseph, who had married Asenath, the daughter of the high priest of On, whose name was Potipharah, meaning the gift of the sun god, where was granted them some land lying between where Cairo now stands and where the Suez Canal has been constructed, the land of Goshen. This may truly be termed the cradle of the Jewish history, for when the time came for them to leave the land, their nations had increased from 66 to 2 million, counting men, women, and children. Moses, the leader of the Exodus under the name of Osarsif, according to some authorities, is said to have held the office of high priest of On. No one of the Hebrews by training and education could have been better qualified to act as leader, and the laws laid down by him for a guidance in morals and hygiene have not been surpassed. These things became possible to him, no doubt, through his training for the priesthood. The Exodus took place in the 5th year of the reign of Menephtah, 1486 BCE. The next point of contact between a Hebrew leader and an Egyptian pharaoh is recorded in 1 Kings 3:1, when Solomon is stated to have married an Egyptian princess, a daughter of one of the pharaohs. Some authorities say that it was from this marriage and his dealings with his wife's nation that Solomon obtained his chief idea of the plan of the temple at Jerusalem, dedicated at about 1005 BCE and destroyed about 588 BCE, and that the two pillars which stood at the porchway or entrance of the temple was erected by Solomon to keep ever before the eyes of the people a memorial of this happy deliverance of their forefathers from their Egyptian bondage, were merely copies of the obelisks which were to be found at the entrance of every Egyptian temple. The lions, too, which decorated the thrones of the Egyptian kings, found a counterpart in the lions on each side of Solomon's throne and the 12 on the steps leading thereto. It is a mere coincidence that two of our grand masters whom we associate, one with the opening of the first or Holy Lodge, the other with presiding at the opening of the second or Sacred Lodge, should be so intimately connected with this mysterious land of the pharaohs. As Masons, the latter relations between the pharaohs and the Hebrews do not concern us. About 2,000 years after the journey of Abraham to Egypt, St. Paul makes reference to the wealth of that people. At varying periods during that time, intercourse between the two nations was fairly close, and no doubt it had a considerable influence on the costumes and beliefs of the Hebrews. To us, as Masons, the fact that many of our Masonic secrets are expressed in the Hebraic or Chaldaic language adds an additional interest to the study of the ancient history of these nations. Alright, so I hope you enjoyed that piece. At this time, I would just like to remind you how to support this program. Of course, you can check out our show sponsor, MasonicRevival.com. Please check them out, as well as BuyBankersBest.com, where you can use promo code BBWCY357 for 20% off. You can check out OnItLabs.com. Just go to WCYPodcast.com, click through the links, and use the promo code WCY at checkout for 10% off. You can head over to FreemasonryArt.com. Check out any number of the amazing things Brother Juan Sepulveda has put together for you, again, using the same promo code WCY. If none of that strikes your fancy, please go ahead and consider picking up one of our lapel pins, which are $10, and for $2, we ship anywhere in the world. That's right. It's a great pin. It's a brass pin. It's got great colors. There's a full esoteric explanation of the pin on our website, wcypodcast.com. Click on support the show, or you can click on buy a lapel pin. The lapel pins are really nice. They've got a great e-clasp on the back so that they don't just pop off. It's got the nice solid backing on the pins. And again, if that doesn't work for you, perhaps consider tossing the show $1.50, whatever you can, over to the PayPal account, which we have set up on the site. Of course, every single dollar goes right back into the show's account, which only gets used for this show and its production. So thank you very much to everybody who is a producer of this program. Greatly appreciate it, and I know everybody else does also. We offer all the episodes all the time, and it's all because of you guys. So thank you so very much. That's it for this week. I hope you enjoyed. We're going to keep on getting better from our sick that's been going around. And I'll talk to you guys all next week on the show at 9:30 Sunday nights. And if you just can't wait, perhaps you may see me on the Masonic Roundtable at 10, 9 Central every Tuesday. It's a great time. You can come on there and you can interact with us live on social media, and we'll answer your questions as we discuss. This week we're going to talk about the secrets of Freemasonry. What? That's right, it's going to be pretty amazing. I hope you guys come on out to join in the discussion. It will be second to none. With that, stay on the level. For Whence Came You, I'm Robert Johnson.
You've been listening to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry with your host, Brother Robert Johnson. Be sure to join us for our next edition.